Previously on Brokers, Bagmen, and Moles.
The FBI was investigating possible massive fraud in the futures markets.
No indictments have been returned, no arrests have been made.
We'll start with the small ones and work your way up to the big ones.
The agent who had been in the pit appeared at the door with another one or two agents.
No one trusted anybody. No one knew who was flipping.
We have that on tape. Don't you want to talk to us about that?
One of the guys in their group did flip, and then they had something.
Seven months all alone in a cage made of stone. 24 hours of isolation, but no prospect of liberation.
This is Pat Arbor. He was the longest-running chairman of the Chicago Board of Trade. You're listening to him reading a poem he wrote while he was in jail. But he wasn't in jail for anything he did while he was at the Board of Trade.
I don't want Pat to rot in jail. I don't get pleasure out of this. This has been a disastrous experience for my children and for me. Pat Arbor had a chance to stay here, go through the divorce process like everybody else does.
That's Pat's former wife, Antoinette. In 2012, she obtained an $18 million divorce settlement against Arbor. Pat decided he did not like that settlement.
So I just decided not to show up for a court hearing. But this was like six, 7 years ago, and I said, gee, I've got 6 or 7 years left. Do I want to spend it in court or go climb some mountains and try to enjoy my remaining years?
Rather than settle his divorce, he fled to Switzerland and moved most of his money overseas. About 5 years later, he snuck back into the U.S. to attend his grandson's graduation and was arrested. As an 81-year-old, he decided to spend 9 months in jail rather than to settle up with his ex-wife. He claimed he lost most of his money in a defunct Portuguese bank and that the rest of it was tied up in a trust that he couldn't access while he was in custody. Antoinette thought otherwise.
And so I think he's doing this because he wants to win. And winning means not giving me a penny.
Eventually, they settled out, and Pat was released. But his prison poetry lives on.
My annual orbit of the sun has only just begun. If I complete the circle, it will be my 83rd girdle. Prosecution of my life by an evil ex-wife has mired me in limbo with nowhere to go.
One thing is clear. Pat Arbor was a rich and powerful man that you did not want to cross. Today, we're talking to someone who did just that and was caught red-handed. I'm Anjay Nagpal, and this is Brokers, Bagmen, and Moles.
They did the usual, we can take your house, we can take this. Where I got in trouble was when I was filling orders. Fucked up, don't do it again, you know. And at that point, everybody's running scared. You know, I'm sure everybody had talked to an attorney. Again, you're not supposed to be a traitor, but, you know, sometimes you got to get out.
Talk about shitting in your pants. I was so fucking nervous.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm John Ryan. Was at the Board of Trade from 1974 until they turned the lights out in 2016.
In episode 1, I interviewed a trader named John Ryan. He He was ultimately convicted of 4 counts of trading violations, such as prearranged trading and trading after the closing bell. The dollar amount of his wrongdoing totaled just over $1,000. He estimates he spent $1 million fighting the charges and a decade trying to get his trading privileges reinstated. In short, the penalty did not fit the crime. It was clear he still hurt by his experience. But despite that, John didn't have much to say when I asked him about the FBI agent in his pit.
I'd rather not. I don't think you want my opinion of it, so.
Oh, I absolutely do. I'd love to get your opinion.
Well, I don't think it'd be beneficial for me. There are a lot of people that built their careers in the government side as a result of that investigation.
John didn't really want to talk about anyone. Not his fellow traders in the pit, not the lawyers, not the judges involved. He was pretty quiet about the whole thing. And then, right before our interview was over, there was one more name on our list of soybean traders that I forgot to ask him about.
I missed a name on here earlier, sir. It was Dave Skrotsky.
Yeah, he was a guy that worked for the government, pleaded guilty, worked for the government, testified against me, made most of it up, all of it up. He should have been charged with perjury.
Wow.
He was using cocaine, selling cocaine. He said whatever they asked him to say. He said whether it was true or not true, and they knew it wasn't true.
Sounds like they were pretty desperate to get, you know.
Well, you know, you do what you gotta do. You're the government. You got all the money, all the time, all the personnel. You know, what do they care? They don't care.
John didn't have the nicest things to say about Dave Skrotsky. So I tracked down Dave online and he agreed to be interviewed.
I really didn't kind of expect anything. And all of a sudden there was a loud banging on the door at 6:15 in the morning.
That's Dave describing the FBI paying him a visit in January of 1989. Since he cooperated, I presumed he would have spent a lot of time with the FBI agents and be able to shed light on the inner workings of their investigation.
They came. Two of them came, this woman and some guy, you know, pulled up in a Mercedes. My wife said, they're not the FBI, they're driving a Mercedes. You know, so he sat me down in the living room and kind of spelled it out for me. I'll never forget my deceased wife coming down the stairs carrying our daughter, you know, tears and what's going on. And
Dave's wife tragically passed away a few years after the investigation. He now lives with his second wife on the East Coast. They seem really happy, and I can't blame him for getting out of Chicago after the ordeal that he went through.
Do you remember anything specifically that they told you were going to be charged with when they first talked to you?
I do not, and I really mean that. I don't know what. They did the usual, we can take your house, we can take this, we can take that. We know how much you paid for your house, we know what your mortgage is, and you know, all that sort of stuff, and we can take all this. You know, they did the head, you know, it was like, you know, a lot of pressure on you.
I can imagine a lot of traders were sitting there and like, this is not a big deal. This is just how business is done.
Bingo. No question. But there was also latent here. Here's, I'll send you 100, you know, I got 100 today that we're supposed to sell yesterday. You can have it 5 cents out of the market. You're going to make money, and then I'm going to want to split, or I'm going to want something out of it. And it was going on all over the place. People who say it wasn't, they're in denial.
Like most traders, Dave talks pretty fast, and it's okay if you didn't catch all the details. He was describing how brokers manipulated customer orders, and he says it was widespread. But he really had no idea what he was facing. The agents were simply there to serve a subpoena, but they stayed for about 2 hours without an arrest warrant or a search warrant.
I was in limbo because I was like, well, I might go to jail.
When I was 12, I started camping at a local golf course. It's called Green Acres Country Club in Northbrook, Illinois. It is now.
If you couldn't tell already, Dave Skrodsky is not like the other traders that we've been talking to. For one, he's the guy that cooperated. He broke the unwritten Chicago code. And the other thing is that he's not from the city, but rather a swank North Shore suburb called Northbrook. Instead of growing up boxing in the streets or spending his summers driving a beer truck, Dave grew up caddying for rich guys on a golf course.
I used to caddy a lot for quote-unquote the gamblers. They were always the best tippers, played for a lot of money.
One of the gamblers was a man named Hank Shatkin, and he ran one of the biggest brokerage firms at the Board of Trade.
So I got friendly with Hank Shatkin, and that's how I got in.
Like T-Bun and Ray and all the guys at the Merck, a connection helped Skrodsky get onto the floor at the Board of Trade. The board was known to be a little more, shall we say, refined than the Merck. But Dave doesn't exactly make it sound tame.
It was a circus. All drugs and, you know, and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it was a really cool place. We were all a very tight group. Great freaking job. It was a great job.
Dave started out as an intern with Shatkin's brokerage firm.
And I pretty much checked trades in the wheat pit. It was intense. I mean, we had some huge markets.
The first thing he learned was to be a trade checker. And this is important because it's one of the main things the FBI asked about. So I think it's worth spending a little more time understanding what a trade checker does.
You would start with the going through the out trades that were processed the night before. You could have 30, 40, 50 pages of out trades. You pretty much had free reign with the traders. I knew whose guys' prices I could change, and they were going to come back and say, wait a minute, why did I get debit $25 or whatever? I mean,
he's saying that most customers never really knew about their out trades because, for the most part, brokers and locals just agreed to fix the trade on the floor and change the price to suit whatever the broker and the customer was supposed to get.
So the letter of the law, I guess, and I'm very clear, I don't know for sure, was I should have handed you the trading card and you would go in broker A and say, broker A, I'm trying to buy this at $850. You're trying to sell it to me at $850.50. You would come back to me and say, Dave, change this price, debit me $50.
So it sounds like there were, you know, quite a fair amount of minor errors in communication between traders and brokers. Would you say that's fair?
A minor? Not so minor.
Dave told me about one big broker who seemed to have a not so minor error every day. But in general, most of the errors were small, and the brokers and locals just figured them out on their own. Because of the rapid growth of the exchanges in the 80s and the high turnover, companies like Shatkin were constantly looking for new brokers. Soon enough, it was Dave's turn.
My 6 months was off, or 9 months, or whatever the fuck it was, and I decided to lease a full seat, and that's what I did. This guy asked me if I wanted to give him some help filling orders. He was a big broker. He said, I need some help for the smaller ship. I said, sure. So I moved from one side of the pit over to the other and started filling orders for him.
But he only lasted a year as a broker before deciding to become a local. He felt more comfortable risking his own money than potentially screwing up customer orders and having to pay for them.
I said, you know, this is enough. It's too much pressure. I'd rather take on the pressure myself.
But just before Dave made the transition to being a local, he was acting as a broker one day for Shatkin and his business partner, who was none other than Pat Arbor, the former Merck chairman from the cold open who chose going to prison over paying his ex-wife a divorce settlement. He was a guy you did not want to cross.
Where I got in trouble was when I was filling orders.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Pat Arbour spent most of his days off the floor managing his brokerage firm and dealing with exchange politics. But just like Leo Melamed and other exchange heads, he liked to speculate on the market. So one day, he sends a buy order down to the pit, and it goes to none other than Dave Skrodsky.
So I had an order to fill for him. I got it filled, and the market took off, and I kept the trade for myself instead of going to New York and changed the price on it.
Remember, back then, brokers could trade for their own accounts and fill customer orders. That's called dual trading, and it was legal. But what Dave did was called front running. He took a trade that was profitable, and instead of giving it to the customer, Pat Arbour, he kept it for himself. And he gave Pat Arbour a worse price. That is definitely not okay. It looked like he got away with it, until he saw none other than Pat Arbour giving him a death stare from across the pit.
Yeah, no question. I traded ahead of his order, took it for myself. No question. He saw me do it, and I said, no, I brought out the date to have it. And I saw you. So you were standing outside the bottle, specifically watching you. It was also very busy, you know. So, yeah. He dragged me off the floor. I had to throw the deck down.
Wow. Arbour just so happened to have come down to the floor to watch Dave basically steal from him.
People were looking at me, and took me into Shatkin's office, and Shatkin was kind of like, you fucked up, don't do it again, you know.
After Pat Arbour flipped out on him and Shatkin took Pat's side, Dave swore he'd never do it again. And maybe he wouldn't have. But little did Dave know, Pat wasn't the only one watching Dave that day. Dave's actions also caught the attention of a guy named Rick Carlson.
Rick Carlson was, I guarantee you, he was, how far is your door from where you're standing now? 8 feet, 10 feet? You know, that's how close he was to me. You know, 15 feet, and he always stood by me. So that's when things started to go south.
Because Rick Carlson wasn't just another local trader. He was one of the undercover FBI agents at the Board of Trade. And when Dave was filling orders, he traded with Rick Carlson a lot.
Nice guy, easy going, wasn't a big, loud or boisterous guy. Or just kind of a easy to talk to, friendly. He played his role well. Good actor.
Did you get the sense that he, A, kind of understood trading?
Yeah, he got it. Mm-hmm. He and I talked about that after the fact. He was a smart guy, and he was, you know, good at what he did. And you know, my lovely wife, even today, still says what you did was wrong, but it was widespread. And Pitt was a big, big place. I don't know if you have a map of where everybody stood that got convicted, you know, or got in trouble. Well, pretty much together.
What Dave is describing here, to me, seems like one of the fundamental stumbling blocks of the investigation. Because they chose to go undercover as new locals who traded small, they could only get exposure to smaller brokers, inherently limiting the scope of the investigation. They would be totally cut off from the biggest brokers. Anyway, I wondered if people suspected Rick was an agent like they did at the Merck.
Not till mid-January 1989. Word kind of started to leak out right at the beginning of the year. It might be undercover people or whatever. Being 30 years old or 31 years old, they're like, well, that's never going to happen here.
Never going to happen until one day you wake up at 6:15 in the morning with the FBI banging on your door. After they left, Dave was advised to stay calm, go to work, and act like nothing happened. He says the next few days were a blur.
The next 4 or 5 days, I met with my attorney, and you know, every day after work, and at that point, everybody's running scared. You know, I'm sure everybody had talked to an attorney. Probably everybody in the fifth had talked to some attorney, and who knew what was going on then. So It all it takes is one, you know, and you can go to jail. So
Dave had a hard choice to make. Sure, he could refuse to cooperate and hope for the best. But remember, he got caught red-handed front-running Pat Arbor's order in front of the whole pit. And the feds told him he could go to jail for a really long time.
Do you remember what your next contact with them, or how did that evolve over time?
Shortly thereafter, being dragged, I would say, to the federal building and meeting with, always with my lawyer, meeting with Tom Durkin.
Tom Durkin was the assistant U.S. attorney at the time.
There was never any action with Carlson. He was gone by now, or Rick Ostrom. In other words, he was out of the pit by then and gone, and everybody kind of figured out it was him, or somehow it got, I have not a clue.
Before we sat down, I was hoping that Dave could shed more light on the FBI's targets or strategy. But since this investigation had been leaked and the FBI agent's cover was blown, they were gone for good. And it was mostly the U.S. Attorney's Office who dealt with Dave from that point on.
It was several days of, you know, here's your options. And I went to Shacken and I said, what do I do? You know, I'm covered. He said, you got to make up your own mind, you know. And then the RICO charges and, you know, so they kind of had my, you know, fingers to the fire. And then at some point, pretty quickly on, I said, okay, fish are cut bait, or again, you're not supposed to be a traitor, but, you know, sometime you got to get out. And I was like, I'm getting out.
Dave met with the U.S. attorneys more than a dozen times. He continued trading on the floor. On May 5th, 1989, he agreed to cooperate. Exactly a week later, on May 12th, they sent him to the floor wearing a wire.
Do you ever watch The Sopranos?
Of course. Yeah, no, I love the mafia genre. I watch all
the time. Chrissy, take everything off. I said everything when Folly does that, you know. I guess you could call that a dick. Remember that scene? So. Yeah.
I could talk Sopranos all day long, but we're here to talk FBI.
So, I mean, that's what it was like. I mean, the wire on, and it was awful.
Do you think it was targeted, or were they kind of spraying and praying to kind of figure out who's who and what's what in this thing?
Probably a little bit of both. There was a whole cadre of stuff, you know, because remember, you think of the pit as like this, for a while I stood over here, but then I moved over here.
The FBI strapped a wire onto Dave and sent him over to a corner of the pit where Agent Carlson wasn't able to infiltrate. His goal? Simple. Get traitors to admit they were cheating.
They didn't have an in on that side of the pit. Yep, Carlson didn't play with those guys watching. They didn't have it again, and there was a couple of pretty good-sized broker groups over there.
Unfortunately for us, Dave was given very little information by the U.S. Attorney's Office. But he agreed to cooperate, so he clicked on his tape recorder and stood by a man named Eddie Cox.
Talk about shitting in your pants. I was so fucking nervous. It lasted 10 minutes.
During our investigation, we obtained transcripts from Dave's tape recorder in the pit. Here's how it went down.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ed. You got a second?
What's up?
Come here. I got a little phone call from my attorney yesterday.
Oh.
And I hadn't heard from him in like 2 months. And he told me that the government is requesting from Shacken my trading cards from 1988 and early 1989.
Yeah?
And specifically, they were asking for in January of this year.
Okay. January of this year?
Remember the trade we made and put Kevin O'Doherty in the middle?
No, not really.
And then he asked Bill about it. He brought it back to Bill.
Yeah?
And Bill asked you about it?
Yeah. I don't I just thought it was a regular trade.
Yeah, but I, you know, I think you told me, you said to Bill, just tell Bill it was an out trade payback, or, you know what I mean?
No, I didn't say, I didn't say anything. I just said it was a regular trade.
Yeah, but you and I both know it wasn't. And what's going to happen if my attorney says they want to know about this and they...
Just a regular trade, Dave. That's the way everything is.
Yeah, but...
Normal trade.
But you and I both know it wasn't. I mean, what happens if they ask me? What am I supposed to do? Are you going to stick to that story if they ask you?
What? There's no story, Dave. That's the way it is. Period.
Yeah, but, Eddie, you know that trade...
Dave.
Eddie.
Every trade that we've ever made has been a legitimate trade.
Well, there's been times when you've been stuck, I've helped you out, or something like that, which is no problem.
Every trade has been a legitimate trade, Dave. And you know it, okay?
But that trade I was giving you...
Including all closes and...
I'm just afraid Kevin might have said something to Bill. You know?
Dave barely made it off the floor that day without throwing up. The new traders that Dave stood by, they didn't take the bait. And that was the last time Dave Skrotsky ever stepped on the floor. In hindsight, that tactic was never going to work, because all the traders were paranoid since the investigation was leaked by the Tribune. The fact that the FBI made Dave wear a wire onto the floor 4 months after that leak, it tells me that the FBI was scrambling for evidence.
I sold my seat for $320 or something like that. Now I have this fairly large chunk of change that I had to live off of. Because, I mean, what am I going to do? You know what I mean? I was in limbo because I... That is an excuse, probably. Versus...
Dave didn't really do anything for at least a year. He stayed afloat from the money he made selling his membership, or seat, on the exchange. He waited for the trials to begin. And like the rest of the traders, he wondered, what the heck was the FBI doing on the trading floor?
The story goes is that Archer Daniels Midland, eating him, and Dwayne Andreas got pissed off, and that's how it started. Does that ring true to what you've heard or read or seen?
I filled Dave in on what I'd learned so far. That I thought Andreas might have played a role in getting the FBI down there, but that I didn't think he was the sole cause of the investigation. I'd hoped Dave could tell me what the FBI was after. Instead, here he was asking me.
You know, again, the FBI spent all this time and money. The fact that they physically couldn't get near the people that they wanted to, the people that could have been the biggest perpetrators, I find almost, you know, there's some dark comedy there.
Remember, I worked in the back office, and I saw some statements. I mean, guys making and losing $750,000 in a day. Come on, there's just too many people, too much business, that there wasn't stuff happening.
As in, there was plenty of illegal activity. You just had to know what to look for.
Part of that just happened to be population, meaning it was so crowded. You know, you aren't going to get up near the top stuff unless you were a pretty big trader. So, 3/4 steps down, you weren't going to do anything.
Do you think that the FBI understood that dynamic going into the investigation?
No, probably not. I would guarantee that.
They'd gotten to those guys who, you know, were big traders or either the brokerage groups or the heads of the exchanges. I think, you know, that might have been a different story.
Because I was on this side of the fence, I think if more people cooperated, the right of it anymore.
To recap, it's clear that a good amount of traders were playing fast and loose with the manual system of open outcry. Most violations seemed relatively minor. But Dave and others, like reporter Bill Crawford, told us that there were much bigger fish who took advantage of the system.
But Pat Arbor trade over the limits and hide the stuff in their accounts. We'd have to always do these transfers, and because he'd trade over the limits, which was against the rules. He used to have two lackeys. I can't remember their names. Small potato guys. So he'd hide his over-the-limit positions in their accounts. And then they'd go get out of them and, you know.
Dave is saying that Pat was trading so big that he was taking directional bets on the market that exceeded the legal allowable trading size for one person. So he found two bagmen and used them to park his trades. This allowed him to have a position three times the maximum allowable size. This is a guy who spent many years as the chairman and vice chairman of the Chicago Board of Trade, using illegal measures to take massive positions in the market. Yet he was never subpoenaed or interrogated by the FBI. I had a few more questions for Dave.
The book makes it seem that, you know, you received a few anonymous death threats. Where do you think that came from?
A couple of people. Mike called me and I did inquire. I will tell you this. I did inquire about what about witness protection. And they're like, my attorney was like, this is not the kind of case. This isn't the gamble. This isn't Tony Soprano. You don't need witness protection.
Before we ended the interview, I had to give Dave a chance to tell his side of the story with regards to John Ryan's allegations that Dave was a cocaine user and seller, and more importantly, a liar.
That's what this guy said about me. Not sure I used drugs. I didn't sell them. I didn't perjure myself. What I have to gain? You know, trust me, it's probably honest. With you, Andre, the only time in my life I have been 100% forthcoming. Sure, I used drugs. Who didn't, you know? Again, so that person, the way I look at it is sour grapes because I'm quite awkward, you know? And broke the code of silence and the word of trade. Not going to rat on each other.
I mean, looking back on those times, would you have done anything different?
I guess I wouldn't have taken for granted, you know, what I had. You know, it's unfortunate that the guy was standing 10 feet from me, you know. But then again, I was doing things that were wrong. Probably too big for my britches. Was a percentage of me doing wrong things? Sure. Was it a percentage of the way they are land? Absolutely. Would I do it again, looking back and cooperating or not cooperating? And I'm not proud of cooperating. I certainly didn't want to do it, you know, but again, no one's going to jail for you, you know, so you're on your own here. Was it worth it? I don't know.
Could you have gone back to trading if you wanted to?
Nope. You know, I was a pariah because I cooperated.
Skrodsky flipped on May 5th. A few more guys followed. And finally, on August 3rd, 1989, nearly 8 months after the Tribune leaked news of the investigation, the head of the FBI and a bunch of other big shots hosted a press conference in Chicago.
The activities uncovered at these exchanges, the largest of their type in the world, simply cannot and will not be tolerated.
I talked to Skrodsky around Thanksgiving of 2020, and it was about that time that I stumbled upon an interesting documentary on YouTube. It was about a legendary Merc trader with a crazy life story.
Louis Borsellino, he is one of the major traders in the Chicago Merc pits, and he joins us now from the Mercantile Exchange.
Louis Borsellino was gone before I got to the floor, but I'd heard his name tossed around in David and Lori's book. He was a big-time trader, but other than an association with ABS Partners, he didn't seem to have anything to do with this investigation. He wasn't in any of the four pits that the FBI were in, and he definitely didn't get indicted. Late one night, while catching up on email and sipping a glass of wine, this was the pandemic after all, I decided to watch Mr. Borsellino's story. And I'm glad I did, because it changed the entire course of this podcast.
I looked at my clerk, Joni, at the time. I said, those guys look like FBI agents or something.
There's something with that guy. And he was standing there, and he was being real friendly, and there was just something about him. And I kept saying, he's a Fed, he's something.
I had to talk to Louis Borsellino, so I called Stretch.
The weird thing is, like, the Borsellinos, they all went to my grade school. It's just a weird, I don't know what it is with Lombard and fucking mobsters. Like, there's a lot of mobsters that grew up in Lombard. It's weird. But yeah, I don't know. If you want to reach out to Louis through Big Tone while I'm reaching out to JJ.
We're all connected.
Yeah.
As predicted, it was easy to find Mr. Borsellino. What I didn't expect was just how many bombs he would drop on us.
So, literally, the defense attorney told me that I was the number one target. The reason was, I must be laundering money for the mob.
That's next time on Brokers, Bagmen, and Moles. Before you go, if you or someone you know might have a hot tip or just a funny story related to our show, we have a hotline for you. Call us at 646-820-1452. That's 646-820-1452. And please follow us on social media. Our handle is at Entropy Media Co. That's at Entropy Media Co, where we'll be posting additional information about the case and awesome behind-the-scenes action. This has been a production of Entropy Media in association with Stretch Productions. This is Entropy's very first show, so if you've enjoyed it, please follow wherever you listen to podcasts and rate us there too. Every follow, rating, or even a personal recommendation to a friend or family member really helps. I'm your host, Anjay Nagpal. Our showrunner and senior producer is Danielle Elliott. Our producer is Jen Swan. Our executive producers are Tim Hendricks, Kevin Stretch Huff, and Dennis Stratton. Original music, sound design, and editing by Gerard Bauer. Voice acting by Shannon Holmes and Robert C. Music clearances by Deborah Manis Gardner from DMG Clearances. Production legal by Bruns, Brennan, and Barry. Legal clearance, fair use by Rachel Strom at Davis Wright Tremaine. Fact checking by Delilah Friedler. Show art by Rebecca Hendon. And from Entropy Media, our in-house executive producer is Josh Fjellstad. Our head of operations is Nuna Ebo. Our project manager is Sebastian Perry. Our associate producer is Heidi Rudvoltz. Our development coordinator is Simona Kessler. And I want to send a very special thanks to Lori Morse and David Griesing.